Hello and welcome. I'm Simon Mundy, and in this podcast I've been talking to Julian Racklin, violinist and increasingly conductor. He has principal conductorships at either end of the temperature zone, one in Norway at the Kristiansand Symphony Orchestra and the other in Israel with the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. Julian's been performing with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe for many years, and recently he became artistic director at the Herbst Gold Festival in Eisenstadt, just on the Austrian side of the modern border with Hungary. One of his first decisions was to invite the COE to be the orchestra in residence there for 3 years. The festival takes place for the most part in the Schloss Esterházy, where Haydn was music director to the richest family in the empire. The ballroom of the palace doubles as the concert hall, and Haydn himself made sure that the acoustics work by having the marble floor replaced by less resonant wood. I began by asking Julian why he'd wanted so much to involve the COE in his festival planning from the beginning.
It's the orchestra I grew up with. I mean, not physically playing in the orchestra, but visiting the rehearsals, the concerts, whatever I could. And of course, most importantly, listening to what for me are reference recordings. I mean, the Beethoven cycle with Hanno Kuhr is an absolute reference. Like, there is a time before that recording and a time after, for me at least. And I've had one beautiful tour of Italy that I remember. That must have been in 2001, so a few years ago, playing Prokofiev II, but anyways, it was a dream come true, let's say, for all of us here at the beautiful Esterházy Palace to have the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, which is undoubtedly, and I don't think I'm exaggerating in any way, when saying one of the greatest, not just chamber orchestras, but one of the greatest orchestras, full stop, as our orchestra in residence, starting this year. I think we are, all of us, not just here, but I think in Austria, but also outside of Austria, are extremely excited about it. And for me personally, it's really like Father Christmas coming and saying, here is your orchestra in residence. I mean, what an incredible luxury, and I'm so immensely grateful and thankful. Don't take this for granted any second.
Do you find there's a difference between playing with them as a soloist, so you were playing the Brahms concerto last night, and then conducting? Is there a different feel for the playing as a soloist with them from conducting them?
That's a very good question. I think that the general dynamic of the orchestra does not change, because the philosophy that this orchestra has is so much comes from listening to each other, from reacting. You know, each group is in such contact, not even each group, every player is so aware of what is happening. They are so aware of the piece, of the score, of it's like making chamber music. It's a very intimate way of communication, and chamber music is the most intimate form of making music, and sort of multiplied, because it is not four or six people on stage, but it's an orchestra. But the philosophy of making music as if you are playing chamber music, I think that is what very much sort of imprints the language of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And whether it is for me standing there with the violin, which of course very few orchestras can do to such a extent, and what I mean by high extent is on such a level, on such a fine level of reacting. I mean, obviously, there is no conductor. I do conduct a few of the big tutti's in a Brahms, but There's so much happening. It's really a symphonic work, and you need to be so attentive and so aware of what is happening to be able to play the Brahms Violin Concerto without conductors. So, I mean, that says, in a way, that says it all. An orchestra that can do that has to be such a exquisite ensemble.
That was Julian and the COE in the Brahms Concerto, in the concert that was recorded at Eisenstadt by Medici TV, and it is from that performance that these extracts are taken. Julian and I went on to talk about how to balance the wind and strings while at the same time reacting as a soloist. Difficult, I suggested.
Yes, and of course we did work also in the rehearsal sound. Maybe the most interesting part. I mean, I don't know if you have that saying in English, but the concert is the dot on the I, but the real happening is always in the rehearsals. That's why, for me, the rehearsals are the most interesting part of a project, of every project. And of course, we did pay attention to it. But you know, when I asked. Musicians to go into the hall to check the balance during the Brahms especially, they said it's an amazing balance. So I mean, we didn't even have to, in a way, with an orchestra like this, it doesn't have to be said. It goes without saying. They're so sensitive, and they see when the soloist is doing something special that is not necessarily even written in the score, and then the whole orchestra automatically reacts. And that is what makes an orchestra a world-class orchestra.
Moving on to your conducting, and there you are conducting Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, which is, while it's a very joyous piece, it's got some very tricky moments. I wondered what your approach to that was.
Yes, of course, the Seventh Symphony is probably, together with the Ninth Symphony, the most triumphant of all Beethoven symphonies. And there are so many ways. There are like a million truths, or a million untruths. There's so many ways to get there, so to speak. But, you know, there is not the one formula which is the correct formula. And of course, that is what makes music making, and especially performing those great works forever interesting and forever inspiring. Because also, the older you get, you know, the views change, the taste changes. I remember as a little child, I had the privilege to have a lesson playing the Sibelius Concerto for Mstislav Rostropovich. And at some point he sort of stopped me and told me the story. I mean, he was great friends with Sibelius, which for me was like completely incomprehensible. And but then he told me a story which had nothing to do with Sibelius. He just said, you know, Julian, when I was your age, I met Sergei Prokofiev. And he told me something that is stuck with me until today. And it's something very trivial, very banal, but it's so wonderful, I want to share it with you. And so he did, and funnily enough, it stuck with me just as much as it was stuck with him. So Prokofiev told the young Rostropovich, young man, you have to brush your taste as often as you brush your teeth. So, and what it meant, or what he meant by saying that, is that when today I'm convinced that this is the right way, or the right interpretation, or a phrase, or, you know, you can go smaller or bigger, you know, the whole piece or one movement, or as I said, one phrase. And today this is your absolute conviction that this is the right way. But tomorrow you have the right to totally question that and to change it. You don't have to be stubborn and believe it for the rest of your life. And in a way, we must not. We have to question. Before and after the concert, we have to doubt everything. I mean, we don't doubt the composition. Don't misunderstand me. But to doubt yourself, absolutely. But when you go on stage, there is no room for doubts. So for these 30 and something minutes, you have to be 1,000% convinced that for right now, this is the one and only right way, even if it's wrong. And before and after, we need to keep brushing our taste. So yeah, of course, I mean, what always is a very big challenge for all of us is the slow movement, of course, marked Allegretto, and it's a morning march. No? So how can a march of morning be Allegretto, marked Allegretto? And so, you know, this is something that we will never know what the truth is, what he had in mind, but probably he didn't want it too slow. And then you have the, you know, the middle section of this movement, which is so full of light and hope, and not at all like a funeral march. So yeah, Allegretto hopefully in the sense of hope.
Part of the slow movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony from the same concert.
In here, in the Esterházy Palace, is Haydn's
place of employment for many a summer. And I just wondered, do you get a feeling in the hall of a spirit of place, of Haydn tapping you on the shoulder, perhaps with a cigar in his hand, and going, Julian, it's a bit slow, could you speed it up a bit? Or, Julian, would you like to take this a little bit more, give it a bit more air, a bit more space?
Speed up after yesterday's fast movements is not possible. I took such, I think, pretty crazy tempi, and the COE was so kind, and they just went for the adventure. So if then he would say, are you crazy for taking such fast tempi? We will never know. We hope that he didn't turn in the grave. But coming back to the spirit, I mean, I know, you know, people who don't believe in spirits will say, oh my God, all this spirit talk. But for us musicians, if you believe in spirit or don't believe, the fact to be here, to know that the history was in fact not just a fairy tale, that all of that did actually happen right here. And that, you know, Beethoven was here, and, you know, I mean, not gonna recite the whole history of Esterházy. It is known, and can, there are so many wonderful books and movies and what have you written about it. But just going on stage and not feeling anything does not exist. You can talk to anybody, even people who go on stage to, you know, put the chair or bring the, or tune the piano, or bring a music stand on stage, I mean, or even just walk around the castle. But especially, of course, making music in a place, in a true place of music history, where some of the greatest music that survived and keeps surviving over centuries has been created, is such an incredible privilege. And yes, I am not a religious person. I mean, I am a religious person in the sense of that the stage is, and music is my religion, and the stage is my church or my synagogue or whatever you believe in. But definitely, this is my holy place, any stage in a way. But a stage like the Haydn Hall is a very, very special one. I mean, imagine the Music for an Indiana did not exist. The Concertgebouw didn't exist. Carnegie Hall definitely didn't exist. But this hall already existed. And
he chose the floor.
He chose the floor, and that's why it makes all kinds of funny noises. And it's good. Let it be. It's Haydn's floor.
Some of the second movement of Haydn's 49th symphony, La Passione. I asked Julian how he wanted to deploy the COE over the rest of the term of its residency.
We already have beautiful plans for, I mean, next year's programs are set, and we are starting to talk for 24. And but I don't know if I'm allowed to reveal the secret.
Let me ask the question around a different way. Is there a particular work that you would personally love to play with the orchestra or conduct the orchestra in?
Absolutely. I would love to introduce Tchaikovsky to the orchestra. I believe that the orchestra has never played the Tchaikovsky symphony before, and we are talking about maybe coming up with just something that will be sort of, yeah, creating an DNA between the COE and myself that has not existed yet. So, yeah, going somewhere else, because this orchestra is one of the most curious orchestras I have ever met, and one of the most open orchestras, and they are open to all kinds of things. No end with these thirsty and curious musicians. So yeah, there's so much one can do and so many directions one can go, and we will, and we are.
Julian Racklin is clearly enjoying the COE's residency in the Schloss Esterházy, and all the orchestra's performances during it can be accessed on the Medici TV website. But to close, here's a little bit more of their collaboration in September 2022 in the Brahms Violin Concerto. I'm Simon Mundy. Please explore the other podcast episodes in our series about the COE, its work, and the musicians it involves.